Good afternoon. My name is Satu Santala. I come from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Finland, and I'm very honored to have been asked to wish you all welcome this afternoon to this very interesting introduction to topics around building state capacity. I will not take a lot of time. I will just introduce our distinguished speakers today, and then we'll take it from there. So, as you know, we are very pleased to have Lan Pritchett with us today. He's Professor of Practice of International Development at Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. And in addition, he's also a Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development. And there's a very long list of things that he's been involved with, I'm sure that many of you know about them, so I won't list everything, but he's been co-editor of the Journal of Development Economics and worked as a consultant at Google, which is very interesting, and also a number of positions at the World Bank and World Bank reports and a number of other publications. Then our other guest speaker today is Michael Wolcock. He's a lead social scientist in the World Bank Development Research Group, where he's worked since 1998. And he's also been for a number of years a part-time lecturer of public policy at Harvard University Kennedy School of Government. His current research focuses on strategies for enhancing state capacity for implementation and so on. Also, Michael is very distinguished with lots of publications. And book chapters and different books. So I won't list also those, but a very impressive list that I'm sure all of you can look at online and be impressed by. I hope this is sufficient by way of introduction, and then we'll take it from there. Right. Go ahead.
And even though there's two of us, we'll try and each keep it short, so we're not going to try and cover the breadth of what we're doing. This in many ways is a post-report on something that Finn Tarp had the foresight to support many, many years ago, and we're coming back to say, you know, every now and again things play out and actually work out in a variety of ways and sort of trickle through the world in ways that we hope are making at least a modest amount of difference. So we sort of want to tell the story of how we came to be doing what we did, and then a little more what practically is going on now at the cutting edge, because it's evolved from a research agenda into more of an action and even a training agenda. So this research agenda grew out of, I think, a sense who had been working in development for a long time, realizing we were focused on the wrong thing. I was trained as an economist, and as an economist, we were trained in policy analysis, and the focus of policy analysis is, what should you do? What is it that, if you were to do it, would lead to successful outcomes? It probably took me 20 years to outgrow that, because I increasingly became aware that the what question was really subordinate to the how question, in the sense of how could you get done anything, and if you focused on how we could get some things done, the kind of what question a bit became secondary, because if you couldn't do it, that things would be better if you could wasn't really particularly helpful relative to building the capability of doing something useful. So we really kind of shifted in our mindset over time from a what approach, you know, what is it that governments or donors or whoever should be doing, to how policies and programs were going to be implemented, in a sustained and scaled way, in a way with reasonable fidelity to design, reasonably as design. I want to motivate this, and I feel like we have in the book and in our papers lots of details and empirical. I want to make this a little more, I want to tell three stories. One that kind of led me to this research agenda. One, I was working for the World Bank. I was in charge of providing $1 billion worth of support to the Indonesian government. Actually, $1.2 billion worth of support in the middle of a crisis in 1998. And the particular domain for which we were providing support was social safety net to mitigate the impact of the crisis. The crisis had doubled poverty basically overnight in 6 months, had tripled rice prices. There were just all kinds of pressing social issues. And one of the elements of the overall fiscal support to restore functioning in Indonesia was a set of safety net programs. One of those programs is a program that was selling subsidized rice, 10 kilograms of subsidized rice to targeted households throughout the country. And I was responsible for what we called in the World Bank supervision, making sure the rice was actually getting out there. So one of the things we immediately realized was that the government of Indonesia was providing us a list of the households that we're targeting. And that list didn't really correspond at all to who was actually getting the rice. Not necessarily in nefarious ways. Sometimes the village was just sharing the rice with everybody on the principle that, everybody contributes to the village and something, manna from heaven, has come down in the village in the form of, this subsidy. Let's spread it across the village. Sometimes some was being lifted by the leadership. A variety of things. So I do the usual World Bank supervision thing. I fly out to a region. The regional officials reassure me this list of the names of the people getting rice, all these people are getting it, only these people are getting it. We have provided the World Bank with documentation of our implementation. Great. Let's go down a unit to get to a village. And, 2 hours later, I have 5 SUVs with me, 10 government officials, all of whom have been reassuring me at each stage that the list of names is exactly the people getting it. I arrive in the village. The poor village head comes up on his motor scooter, having been tracked down in the field, thinking, I am sure, what did I do wrong in this or a previous life that I have to... No good can come of 5 SUVs full of government officials showing up in my village. We say, we're here to talk about how the rice is distributed in your village. So, great. And I say, here's the list of people's names that are getting in your village. Are really only these people getting it? And he says, yes. And I say, really? Because in other villages, they're sharing it more equal than just these people on the list. He says, oh, of course we're sharing it more equal than just those people on the list. So it took that much investigation to reveal. And then he discussed that he actually had a sophisticated thing where all the household, they got it once a month. All the households on the list got it every month. And the households not on the list got it every other month. So they divided into the targeted households and the non-targeted households. So the non-targeted households got about half as much as the targeted households. And he said, look, if I tried to give it only to the targeted households, they would tear me to bits. Right? It wasn't perceived as fair. I said, fair enough. And we knew this was going on. So at that point, I turned to the officials that for the previous 2 hours had spent all of the trip in the SUV reassuring me that their reporting was exactly accurate. And I said, why have you been telling me for 2 hours that rice was going only to these households? If it took me this long to figure out that's not true, you must know it's not true. The official looked me in the eye and said, well, you're from the World Bank. You've never wanted to know the truth before. And it was a very good point. We really hadn't wanted to know the truth before. We had wanted to get the reports that it was being delivered. And kind of as long as the reports were all, you know, plausible and delivered on time, we were happy. So I realized that the gap between what was being implemented and started and designed and discussed of how we in the center were going to target this rice, there were lots of slips of various good and bad kinds to what actually happened in the village, and we had paid far too little attention. We really kind of hadn't wanted to know the truth before. We were happy to, you know, for the paperwork to look good. A second story is I was working later, and again for the World Bank, in regionally in India on local government issues, and I traveled to Afghanistan in 2006 to the World Bank office, and we meant to travel more widely, but as we got there, we were limited to the World Bank office because the country wasn't secure enough for us literally to leave the building in the World Bank. So I had plenty of time for discussions with the other World Bank officials as to what the government was doing to build governmental capability in Afghanistan. It turns out, living in the building, which, again, we got to know well, since for 3 days we couldn't leave the building, were three consultants that had been hired as part of the World Bank's governance project, and their job was to create the job descriptions and qualification descriptions for each level of the incipients to be recruited and restaffed in Afghanistan's civil service. And the job descriptions were very detailed, and this were the qualifications that it would take to be a level 15 Afghan civil servant versus a level 14 Afghan civil servant. And that was literally the dominant effort towards building governmental capability undertaken by the World Bank in a country that had a desperate need of government capability. And it occurred to me that the phrase deck chairs on the Titanic didn't quite capture it. This was the drink holders in the drinks in the cup holders on the deck chairs in the Titanic that we were focused on and paying millions of dollars for expat consultants to sit in Afghanistan to do, that really had no conceivable chance of making any difference to whether Afghanistan emerged with a government capable of undertaking the array of tasks it needed to undertake, even to survive as a government. And yet, you know, this was the World Bank's contribution to governmental capability. Finally, I want to show you just one kind of empirical slide and then come back to the story. Just recently, I did a survey of youth in Indonesia aged 14 to 18. And tried to assess kind of their skill set, not in a school setting, in a household interview setting. One of the questions they asked was this question, in exactly this way. Girl went to bed at 9:30, open at 6:30, how many hours did she sleep? This is not arithmetic, right? You can answer this question with your fingers, which is how I would answer it. I want you to guess and write down your guess of how many people of the youth, and this is this year, this isn't 30 years ago, this year, what percent could answer this question that had less than 8 years of schooling, 8 years of schooling, and that were actively enrolled as undergraduates in an institution of tertiary learning? Write down your guess. Because if you don't write down your guess, when I show you the answer, you'll go, oh yeah, that's what I thought. So, or at least think of a number, and particularly think of a number for this one. I'm going to put you on the spot, Tony. What fraction of youth in India enrolled as undergraduates in tertiary education can tell time?
80%?
And you're a cynic. You're old. So Only 41% of youth who've completed 8 years of schooling, 41% can tell time. And again, if you show them a clock that says 9 o'clock, they can tell time, but they can use time in any kind of practical way. And only about a little more than half of people enrolled as undergraduates can answer this question correctly. So let me tell you one more story, which is I was just visiting a project whose purpose it was to get, I'm probably going on too long. Whose purpose it was to basically go into villages in India, because they knew education learning was performance, and they wanted to highlight the low learning and motivate action around low learning between the parents and the school. And they they spent a week and they surveyed every kid in the village about their capabilities on simple reading and arithmetic tasks. They prepared a report with their informants and participants from the village, and then they had a village meeting with the village head, the school principal, the school teachers, and the villagers, and presented these results. And the results were dismal. That many of the kids who had spent 5 and 6 and 7 years in schooling, completely, totally illiterate. I mean, couldn't read a single sentence. And I'm watching this meeting play out, and they present this result, and a man about my age stood up, and he said to the people on the stand, the village head and the principal, "You've betrayed us. You told me that if I didn't make my child work in the fields and I sent him to school, that his life would be different than mine. I have worked like a donkey my whole life because I didn't have an education. And you told me that if I sent my child to school, his life would be different. And now I learn that my child is destined to be a donkey his whole life too, because he hasn't learned what he needs to know to do anything other than the brutal, hard field labor that I've done my whole life. It's taken me years of telling this story before I don't actively cry every time I tell this story. And I'm a pretty hardened, cynical development guy. I've seen a lot of terrible things. This was one of the most poignant, sad things I had ever seen in my life. The principal responded to this by saying, "Of course your child's a donkey. You're a donkey, and donkeys are born of donkeys. I can't possibly be held responsible for the fact that your child can't read. Your child is incapable of reading. It's not my fault." In front of 100 villagers. Then I realized, building the capability of this system that has principles that will, in front of 100 people, say things like this, that they believe them is bad enough, but that they will say them, means the capability of the system to produce genuine learning universally among children in India is going to be an incredibly difficult task, and that we shouldn't actually be that surprised if those are the people populating the system, they're responsible for educating children, that we're getting these disastrous results. So this is how we got, I think, the three of us to the capability issue. That unless we worked on the fundamental concern with actual performance and results of the organizations responsible for implementation, no design, no budget, no program was going to make a difference. You can't program your way out of the kind of lack of capability, by which we mean ability and willingness to orient towards performance. Without that, kind of everything else we were designing, doing, budgeting was learning. And we sort of have two things, and I'm just going to go through these very fast. One is that the first thing we had to understand is how it can be so awful and stay so awful. Right? If you don't... I mean, India is not new to development. Like, India has been an independent sovereign state with a full-fledged and functional democracy for 50 years. It's not as if this level of malperformance is teething pains of a new country. This has been persistent low performance. And so partly what we wanted to understand is what we call the techniques of successful failure. How do you fail to educate children for 50 years and yet robustly survive and thrive at being the education system and continue to receive budget and continue to extract taxes and continue to hire teachers and continue to project yourself as the legitimate education system? And we talk a lot about two particular techniques, which we'll maybe come back to: isomorphic mimicry. You can survive by looking like a ministry without actually having the underlying concern for one. And premature load bearing, which is always adopting the best practice at the center while not really paying attention, never really worrying about the truth. There's always action at the top. The management is always embarked on the latest, greatest, best practice reform without ever concerning about the reality of the organization. And that these organizational techniques were actually an optimal response to the situation the organization was in. Meaning, if I were in charge of the organization, I would be tempted to adopt these same two techniques because they were actually survival techniques in the environment you were placed. Then finally, we came towards PDAA because we were not cynics. We were not defeated. We actually saw in the development space lots of successes, many of those successes at scale and many of those successes sustained. And we said, what separates the cases, conditions, and places that create and sustain success in building capability and those that don't? And the three of us, I'm an economist, Michael is a sociologist, Matt is an expert and trained in public administration. We had worked in lots of places, lots of different sectors and fields, public finance, the justice sector, education. And we sort of inferred common principles that were present in successes and absent in failures. And the PDIA was sort of problem-driven iterative adaptation, was our description of the set of principles that successes tended to have and failures and these are, you know, failures at scale and sustained and failures that donors and others actually support and look like an alternative strategy. Problem-driven versus solution-driven, meaning the organization is actually focused on performance versus the organization is focused on projecting the implementation of a pre-given solution. Iterative, which means the actual implementation of the project involves active feedback loops at all levels versus a design, a programmatic design that's not iterative. It's, this is what the program is going to be, and then the attempt is to make the organization implement with no feedback loops. And finally, adaptation, which allows the design to change flexibly over time, over adaptation learning cycles that only adapt periodically. So that's where that's where the sort of origin of this is basically a group of us realizing we were pursuing the wrong thing, a group of us realizing that capability was the key and yet persistent, unbelievably low capability was combined with strategies to building the capability that were deeply false. Meaning that everything deeply false and shallowly false is, it wasn't that the devil was in the details. It was the devil was all the way up, all the way down. The fundamental strategies for building capability were wrong, not the way in which those strategies were pursued or funded or designed. And then finally trying to say, what's an unproven but potentially right approach? And to be potentially right, it had to be different. and we would rather be wrong and potentially right than be involved in reinforcing business as usual. With that, I'll turn it over to Michael.
Okay. All of that culminated in this, in this book that that came out 2 years ago, but had been gestating, as it were, during the period that we were the beneficiaries of funding from WIDA here. That the products of the WIDA work was a series of working papers and the beginnings of our own strategy for thinking about how we would not just do the things that you would expect researchers to do, but that we work where we work because we're impatient researchers. We don't just we want the sort of long routes to impact, as it were, just by writing papers and hoping the world suddenly comes across your obscure papers and obscure journals and somehow changes. Or you practice what you preach. You sort of try and actually put these ideas to the test and get them incorporated into real countries with real problems and with real programs and real budgets, and you try and make that work. And you learn from that. And so what we did was to call this sort of a perpetual second word, right? If the first word people are the geniuses that come up with something truly new, and if the final word people are the ones that produce the sort of the QED proof, thus it is so, and forever hold your tongue, like, there had to be a middle space. And when you hear what Lanta said, and if you're familiar with larger parts of the book, you would, and you know your development history at least, I think you would recognize that in some sense we weren't ever claiming to be deeply original. If you look at the epigraph quotes that we cite at the beginning of the book, we go back even thousands of years biblically to sort of groups that were frustrated by being told that if they wanted to be a real country, they had to have a king, for example. And real countries have kings. And these biblical passages are all about, no, don't just copy the people that want to have a king. Having a king is a really dumb idea. And more recently, one of my favorite quotes from an Indonesian education reformer on the cusp of the end of the colonial period of Dutch rule was sort of lamenting the fact that so many different things had been given to them, but so much of it fits so ill with our own style or is so far removed from it that we use it as best as a decoration, right? And that was just a magic quote, right? And that's the essence of isomorphic mimicry right there, right? Cute things we can hang on the walls of our houses that sort of somehow we have been given in the name of development that just fit so ill with our own style that we can't use them. And so they end up just being decoration. Right? So if you take those kind of ideas were lurking right at the beginnings of the whole enterprise of development, and then fast forward to sort of the kind of approaches that Albert Hirschman was calling for explicitly, explicitly arguing that development was this long voyage of discovery, right? In all these domains, from technology to politics, it was all about trying to figure out how to do this kind of stuff. And it was a long journey and epic adventures, as he once called it as well. Is this that sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but it's just a lot of times entails doing this very difficult exploratory work, right? So I say all that because we didn't want to be claiming that somehow we'd cracked in code and come up with something new. But neither did we also want to say that, well, we're just reprising what they'd done as well. Right? We did want to think that we'd taken that idea a step further. And the one way in which we'd done that was to have a much richer empirical base to support this. The book itself is written in two halves. The first half sort of lays out the theory and the evidence, the more traditional things you would expect to see in an Oxford University Press book. And then second half, the book's an entirely different genre, in effect. It's really a series of work programs for how you can do this kind of stuff. Lance sort of told you it's one of his three favorite stories. One of his many sort of famous aphorisms, I think, is you don't beat something with nothing, right? And a lot of our concern with this older literature was that it was very strong on critique. It had lots of sort of sharp, insightful passages about the evils of big planning systems and what they've done. And speaking of Hayek and a whole bunch of other people over every decade, I list them up on the screen there, a whole series of very venerable, smart people had written a lot of stuff stressing that so much of what was really mattering just wasn't able to be captured in a long frame, that the high modernist bureaucratic systems that we had just couldn't do the work we were now asking them to do, etc., etc. So we wanted to be aware of those intellectual history, as it were, but we didn't want to just stop there. We were crazy enough to sort of say, well, not just sort of here's what's wrong with the past, as it were, here's our neck. We're going to go out on a limb and try and articulate some at a level of principle, not in a strict recipe, that would be the antithesis of what we're really trying to do, but here's if we want to turn an acronym into a work program, if PDA is going to become supportable, fundable, implementable, then it has to offer some quite specific kinds of approaches and tools that people might be able to use. And so the second half of the book was all about doing that. I think our other critique of the orthodox work, or at least the intellectual history that we were inheriting, was that it had largely stayed academic, in the sense that you could see this on syllabi, you could see this stuff cited in Google Scholar and all the rest of it. But it not only had it not offered a sort of an applied set of tools for actually offering a supportable alternative, but it hadn't really explicitly reached out to the people that do development, the practitioners, the people who wake up every day and are trying to do this thing called implementation. Most academics don't actually do that. They write papers. And our book is explicitly dedicated to people that wake up every day on the front lines of trying to run the kind of schools that Lant described in India or elsewhere, but who are just deeply frustrated by the fact that so much of their own systems, or even worst case scenario, is compounded by the kind of support they might receive from the international community, only exacerbating their challenges. And if we were going to be addressing this in a very different way, we have to have a demand side component to all of this. We're going to supply the better idea. They have to build out a whole community of people that were going to do this at scale, not sort of cute little small ones around the place. There had to be a strategy for building this out. And one of those strategies entailed making the book open access, right? So it's a month's wages if you're a sort of frontline Kenyan health official to doing this kind of work. None of us would spend a month's wages on a book. So we really took seriously giving the book away. But we also built out a whole training program, which I'll get to later as well, an online platform also given away for free. Now it's reached well over 1,200 people, largely through the work of our wonderful colleague Salima Samji, who's sort of overseen all of this kind of work, as an explicit complement to the intellectual work. It won't hold up if it doesn't have the scholarly foundations in place, and we took that very seriously. But we also recognise that the world's not going to change just by shouting from a mountaintop. You have to actually build out a whole social movement of people that are committed to, and not sort of following this faithfully in a strict, narrow sense, but taking these ideas and the spirit of this kind of work to figure out in their own place, in their own sectors, in their own countries, in their own scales of operation, within their own mandated space, to try and do this in a different kind of way. Right, so that's really the very specific things that we have tried to do to try and make this be available to everyone, bring out the training programs. And the third one is commit to a broader and evolving community of people that are doing all sorts of things under a broad label that we can just loosely call doing development differently. A movement that we helped launch with ODI, the Overseas Development Institute in London, back in 2014, well before the book came out. But cognizant that at that particular time, that a range of different development organizations in the world were beginning to at least talk about this kind of stuff in a different way. Right? To change things, you've got to give people new ideas, you've got to think about things differently, then you've got to be able to talk about these things differently, but ultimately you've got to do it differently. Right? And it's hard to do things differently. There's a reason that the incumbent system is there. It's very powerful. It has very strong incentives not to change. And if people are going to go out on a limb and perhaps risk the opprobrium of their colleagues or resistance from people, sometimes for good reasons, they need to know that they're not doing that alone, that they need to sort of recognize that there are other people out there who are also trying to work as a faithful employee of their organization to do the right thing, but are really trying to see their task as not just being faithful in a compliant sense with the rules that they have to work with, but faithful in a sense of fulfilling the mission of their organization and presumably, hopefully, the mission of the of their counterparts. And so I'll talk a bit shortly about the ways in which this evolving social movement around the world is evolving fitfully and with all sorts of different acronyms and a whole different languages and phrases and concepts being deployed. But I think really important, because it's only by fully expanding the tent, as it were, that we can set up different kinds of booths within the tent that cumulatively will start to add up to a countervailing force and a coherent, credible countervailing force for doing this stuff differently. So the Building State Capability book, as you just saw on the screen, gave rise to the Building State Capability program, which we run out of the Kennedy School under the directorship of Salima. So that particular work, and the operationalization of that largely through Matt Andrews, is through direct engagements with governments. Right? So the second half of the book is very programmatically laying out the very specific things that we think the full package of PDIA constitutes, as it were. And various different governments around the world have worked with us in Albania, in Mozambique, Sri Lanka, now in Honduras, working very particularly with a particular authorizer. We're really big on authorizing environments for doing this kind of stuff. You can't just waltz in and sort of schlop around. You've got to have a full endorsement of powerful figures in a government, rightly, whose job it is to decide what happens in their particular part of the organization. And we've been invited by those kinds of people to be, with a long-ish time frame, often a year or more, to be able to build out the capability of those of a particular team within a particular ministry in a particular country, right? So that's the full PDIA experience when that option is offered to us, and we have the time and the resourcing to do that, the human resourcing to do that, then we have that as part of what we do. We have these online training programs, because with the Kennedy School, we also do some of this through executive ed training programs. And then, of course, the usual things that academics do, which is crunch out working papers and blogs and other ways in which we talk to each other. So the way in which the scholarly community talks to itself and to others who might be doing this kind of work. All of us, though, as I explained to you, sort of we all three of us come from different disciplinary backgrounds, work in different sectors. The book was a product of sort of turning those Venn diagrams and overlaps into this, but we still have our own ongoing work. And I'll talk a bit about some of the applied research that's happening to sort of demonstrate that this is still work in progress, and will perpetually be so. Trying to get a much richer handle on the dynamics of implementation in different countries and in different sectors at different scales of operation. And we've also produced, or at least part of what we do, at least the World Bank as well, is produce these case studies around how all this is happening. So we have a record of how these teams of people were actually able to do this kind of work. Because it's important that experience not be lost. Even if it's deeply idiosyncratic, even if it can't really be replicated as such, it's important that we have record of how people did these things, often in really difficult circumstances with a really tough context, with a limited time and budget envelope, nonetheless were able to do these kinds of things. And being able to map that out and have a good record of that is really important. The final aspect is this, connecting it to the Doing Development Differently movement that I mentioned before, and having now not just engagements directly with governments, but having the array of donors or my organization, the World Bank, within its own roof, within its own house, having their authorizers of people that have that think in this space, we can try and do something very differently. Probably one of the most interesting talks that I've heard in the last 5 or 6 years was by a senior DFID official at the very first of our Doing Development Differently seminars, who was speaking to a group of our Kennedy School students and was saying, "You know, I used to be you. I used to be 28. I wanted to change the world, and now I'm 58. Now I actually have real responsibilities at DFID. And there's things I can do that you can't do, and there's things that you can't do, things that you can do that I can't do. One of those things is that I kind of have power. I have money. I have decisions, and I want my 28-year-old self, if it was able to speak to my 58-year-old self, to like me." And I would want my 58-year-old self to take seriously the responsibilities that I now have and still be as equally committed as I was at 28, perhaps with some naivety or some irrational exuberance to commit to keep changing things. And so it's a very important speech, I think, about how senior officials, if they are as committed to that 58 as they were when they were 28, can actually push the bars of in the iron cage that they seem to reside in and realize, no, they're rubber. They're not made of steel. You can actually push them if you know what you're doing. And this kind of work now is being taken up in that space. This time next week, I'll be in New Zealand at the invitation of their aid agency, who is really trying to retool much of the way in which they do their development work in the Pacific. And they have seen in this kind of work something that they think will be very applicable to them as New Zealand engage with many of the Pacific Island countries, which are anthropological paradises in one sense, but deeply needing to figure out their own way of building their capability and becoming a state in the 21st century. And in this, they see something that they can work with. And so we go there. And they all take out of that, I guess, what they feel they can work with. Let me just quickly talk about some of the ways in which this is working out in an applied research sense. I think one of the ideas that comes out of the public health literature from several years ago is this idea of positive deviance, of learning from standard deviations rather than just local treatment effects, which is sort of how much of econometric work is done. Trying to recognize that the essence of doing complicated work, the essence of doing contested work, is that it's just going to produce big standard deviations. It's just going to produce big variations. And then the question is, well, why and how and where do you get that variance and what drives it? And so that calls for a very different kind of research input to be able to untangle and explain these forms and sources of variation. In this big book I did 4 years ago now on service delivery in the Middle East, our approach wasn't just to stack up country A versus country B, C and D, Egypt versus Libya versus Palestine, and just the usual way bar graphs and sort of say, well, you guys should do more like those guys. try and do work with the existing household data sets though, as best we could, to really try and map out variation in each of these countries, which for research purposes are really nice because they're super centralized in terms of the way in which they have their policies determined. So if you see big subnational variation, it can't be a function of, well, they have different policies, because all the policies are the same, all their civil servants are being paid in the same structure, all those civil servants went to the same training school. So when you see this big variation beyond just this thing called context, we need to look much more at these questions of implementation capability. And it turned out to be really interesting both for us, but as it turned out for many of the client governments of the Middle East where this kind of work was being done. Yeah, some of you may know of Union Ang's wonderful book on China, where again she tells her whole story by being able to look at these big subnational variations in the ways in which this thing called policy in a super centralized country like China nonetheless plays itself out, and how is discretion devolved in this otherwise centralized system down to the local level. How do you build out and encourage people to be much more entrepreneurial as civil servants to be able to court investment, for example? And so she explains how that works in a very granular and interesting way. And I think this isn't PDIA in the sense of this is what they thought they were doing, but this is really interesting examples of how you can learn from the existing sources of variation and see that as a really fruitful entry point for how one goes about doing this. So this is just one example of a slide from this work we did looking at absenteeism among doctors. And here we just have it at the level of the region, right? And you have this nice sort of 80-20 sort of gap between the best and the worst. Here we go down to the districts in Yemen, right? Again, this sort of this huge variation, right? So the average is there, say at 33 or 35. But averages don't really tell you that much at face value. What's super interesting is to try and explain why in a world in which absenteeism in some places is 83%, 4 out of 5 people just not even showing up for work every day, if that's normative, how is it that some other places only have 1 out of 5 people missing work? Probably because of legitimate reasons, because they're sick, right? So how do you create a local culture in your workplace such that you subvert this normative expectations that you can kind of goof off and do whatever you want and actually enable your system to function more effectively, right? So I think this is one way in which you can do work that's very consistent with the principles of PDA without necessarily having to be all in on taking every single piece of the second half of our book. I was hoping Lant wasn't going to present this slide because I'm going to use it shamelessly to tell two stories that he could have told, which is, again, as he's looked at the difference between performance levels. This is sort of looking at levels of tertiary graduates in Jakarta versus high school dropouts in Denmark who score identically with regards to how they function on these performance scores. Right? And bear in mind, of course, that the people who are dropping out from high schools in Denmark are probably the poorest, whereas the people going to universities in Jakarta are probably the richest. Right? So there's huge, big differences in the functionality of these systems. But back to this 80-20 sort of rule almost, I'm just almost seeing at the levels of completed primary school. All these countries, of course, have policies regarding the importance of having their children complete at least primary school, and yet huge variation with respect to the capabilities of those different systems of education to actually turn the policy into a lived experience. Right? So doing this kind of work, you can do it ad infinitum. You can do it anywhere and everywhere in principle, but it's a huge research agenda, I think, for being able to be much more granular in terms of how we help systems learn by being able to have much richer understandings of where, how, why, and for whom the existing policy apparatus seems, nonetheless, when it hits the road, as it were, to perform in such different kind of ways. I'll conclude just by sort of briefly summarizing some of this stuff that's happened with the Doing Development Differently community. We've had six or more different meetings pretty much annually since we started the first one back in 2014. Without any sort of deep strategy, every time we've held one of these meetings, it's largely been self-organized by a particular group of people that have decided they're ready to host this one. We had one 2 months ago in Berlin, sponsored by GIZ, the German Development Agency. Really interesting groups of people. They're always really interesting people. Not necessarily all doing this thing we call PDA, but doing development differently, in their own way, in their own space, figuring out how to make their system function more formally. And it's so exciting to be with those kind of people, but that's because you self-select for a kindred spirits, for people that are trying to make this stuff happen in often very difficult kinds of circumstances. I think one of the boring but crucial issues for our agenda is figuring out how we can help people in the administrative space with procurement, especially, and with accounting issues. Right? How do you take an existing system built around a log frame with very standardized ways of running contracts and being able to make money flow, the round pipes, as we sometimes call it, meet with a world where you're trying to be very adaptive, where you don't even know sometimes what the exact solution is to the problem that you're looking for. Right? How do you write a contract around that? How do you give money out? So how do you pay people? How do you contract and write and issue sums of payments to people when the existing system might not be set up to do that? So how do you get a workaround between the square pipes and the round pipes? Who's the genius accountant or lawyer that's figured out the apparatus that can connect the round pipe and the square pipe without water flying everywhere? That's the kind of stuff that it's super boring for some people, but super exciting for other people, because that's, you've cracked the code if you can figure out how to make the old and the new work. And we're starting to see examples of that kind of stuff happening. So we kind of sort of call ourselves architects. We design you the nice house, but everyone knows if the house is going to work, you've got to, you turn the tap, the water's got to come out. When you flip a switch, lights have got to come on. That's a whole different skill set to build out that apparatus for doing all of that kind of work. And we don't pretend to have the answers to that, but we do recognize how important all of that is. And a fully fledged, emergent alternative to orthodoxy is going to have to be able to speak to those issues. And that's where we're trying to PDAA, trying to keep this perpetually in the second word phase, so that these kinds of things emerge out of the practices that people are doing, not because a lone genius figures out in a cave how to crack that. It'll happen because of a community of people that is able to work together, to be able to learn from each other, to iterate and adapt their way to this kind of solution that they need. So that's kind of where we're at. And I just want to close by thanking Finn again and the wider community more generally for getting this started, because this was only in our wildest dreams possible for us, Lance and I, to give this kind of talk in 2019 when we first pitched our thing with 100 slides in 2012. It was, we've got a bunch of ideas. We've lived this long enough and we're at an age where we think we've got enough gray hair to be able to be taken seriously if we try and mobilize a research and operational agenda around all of this. And fitfully, imperfectly, but nonetheless quite realistically, this is all starting to happen. And thank you to all of the wider community for being present at creation, as it were, for enabling all of this to happen. We hope to come back periodically and update you with what this has done. But we're not. It's not about us. This is about the people who actually do the really, really difficult work. Lant gave you his heart-rending story, just my most recent trip to Nigeria, where I was looking at a team like this, for doing this kind of work. They're just, you're interacting with birth attendants that haven't been paid in 6 months. Right? They haven't. The exit option just isn't there for those people. They can't go on strike. If they go on strike, babies die, right? So they have to keep going to do this work. And they look at me, here, oh, the World Bank official has arrived. Finally, this person is going to be able to fix my problem. And so what do I say to people like that? Oh, you should do a PDA course. I mean, that'd be facile, right? But we've got to try and make these systems work for those kind of people so that every routine things, like getting paid for what you do, actually happens, and that they in turn will show up for work to do their part of the most elementary aspect of the social contract. And those kind of issues you don't solve with fancy technology. You only solve it by building out a whole different normative culture within your organization and a whole very powerful set of incentives for making that routinized as the new way in which things get done. And if this book achieves its agenda, it will be when those systems do seamlessly what they're supposed to do, not necessarily because we get a lot of attention for it. It's about giving it back. It's about giving it back to the people that risk their lives often on a daily basis to do this work, and so often find that what we are doing is not helping. And we are responsible for what we do, so we're trying to articulate an alternative to that. But in the spirit of perpetual second wordness, we want to get your feedback and your thoughts about where you think some improvements might be sought, or where you think the limits of this might need perhaps a third alternative way of moving it forward. Well, thanks very much. Okay. So just leave that up. That's obviously ways in which this is happening within the World Bank, but I don't need to lay all that out. Stuff's happening. It's overwhelming, but it's good. And I'll just leave it at that. But if you have comments or questions for either of us, we'd love to hear that. So.
Yeah, thank you very much. Very lively, good presentation. I must say I'm a great fan of you. I'm working in a ministry for foreign affairs, and I've sent something like 10 different emails all around to people. Please read this book, because this is important. This is really important for us. It's practical. Or it's almost practical for us, because we are really administrators, and there are other people who are really good in business, but we should understand. So the first part of the book is very sort of a convincing story about why, and the second part is really very important in telling how we should do it. I have just one question about, and this relates to the kind of a way that you say that you have to start when you start to work with governments, to start with small, to expand, to try to adapt and to do slowly, step by step. And that's good. And then you use the word authorization to describe that in order to keep going, in order to get really results, you have to keep on getting the leaders on top of that. Now, that's a difficult part, how to keep the leaders on top of that. So my question is now like this, that for example, Kunal Sen has studied in Rwanda the cases whereby having a rather sort of authoritarian regime with a certain level of stability guarantees that you are able to get this kind of a step-by-step in a ministry level really to happen. So my question is Kunal's thesis about authoritarian regime somehow a sort of a precondition for your step-by-step work in a ministry level to work out?
Is that your story, Kunal?
Almost.
I think the book is called Building State Capability. Right? So that's what we care about fundamentally, because we think too often governments can't do what they need to do. The broader development question, improving the functionality of both the public administrative system and the political apparatus that produces leadership and authority within a system, is that itself is part of the development business. When Paul Kagame spoke at the Kennedy School 2 years ago, I don't know if the lamp was going to respond this way, but I'll steal a line. He asked him a wonderful question. He said, thank you, Mr. President, for coming along and speaking to us today, but what's the worst piece of advice you've ever received from the international community? And he sat there for about 30 seconds in silence, and then he said, the worst piece of advice is whenever people come into my country and presume they know what my problems are. I think I'm paraphrasing you more or less. And I think the essence of what we're trying to do is within the prevailing leadership structure, which has presumably some form of legitimacy imbued with it, you're trying to help that system do a better development work than it might otherwise do. I guess by logic, an authoritarian regime perhaps has a longer and more robust sort of authorizing space. But last year I did a book on PFM, public financial management reform in Indonesia, in Southeast Asia, and one of the really interesting cases was of Indonesia, which had gone through 6 federal elections and had kept over an 18-year period a commitment to this PFM process in a proto now actual democratic country. So I think the broader question of where authorization can come from doesn't have to inherently rely on it. Might be slightly easier in a technical sense for that to function inside an authoritarian regime, but the beauty of a truly legitimate reform process is that all sides buy into this and we're able to imbue it with different kinds of legitimacy precisely because it's able to withstand multiple electoral shifts and different ways of functioning. And so I think if one needs to be, you need to be careful about how you respond to these kinds of requests, but I think that if you see what you're doing as part of a broader development challenge, then you recognize that part of what you're doing here, whether it's with a Rwanda-type government or with an Indonesian-type government, is that you're ultimately trying to build out the functionality of that space. And it isn't inherently easier because you happen to do that in an authoritarian environment. Do you want to respond to that any different kind of way? No? Okay. Any other comments or questions or concerns or reflections? Sir?
What's the relationship between this and the good governance agenda? Ah. You seem to be, if you have PDIA, it doesn't have D at the end. Democratic follows from the last person. It doesn't have democratic at the end. I'm just using that as an illustration, but in some sense, I don't think the good governance agenda is the way to go. And it does, it's like the decoration of your Indonesian quote. But the thing is, what you're doing in some sense is you're maybe ignoring it, you were maybe bypassing it. So the question is, I suppose, how do you perceive your relation with that? How, in your presentations and your rollout, does it interact with that? Okay. Because I would see it, it's like what you've got is a good enough governance agenda or something like that. But this to me is a direct challenge to what the donors have been pushing forward for the last 20 years?
Yeah.
So how does it interrelate? How does it interact? How would you deal with that? You just ignore it. You just kind of say we're not, So those
would be So I think, sorry, you are very perceptive. It's exactly the opposite. Yeah. The good governance agenda is basically been concerned with form, not function. It's been projecting isomorphic mimicry. It's been holding elections in the DRC, which just can't possibly be relevant. It's civil service classifications in Afghanistan. So we're very much in the good enough governance school of thought. And by and large, I think we hope if we ignore it, it will die of its own stupidity. and a certain amount of blah, 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 blah at the highest level about good governance is going to happen. But this is a mechanism for actually on-the-ground action that can boil up to produce capable states. And so you're exactly right that this is exactly the opposite. It, you know, I think the good governance agenda had many of the features of, you know, what we call premature load bearing, which is trying to do too much, too fast, too soon, to where, you know, you go into a country that hasn't made any progress in 30 years and some government program promises it'll get three times better in 5 years. And it's just stupid. It's not going to happen. It's not going to work. It's going to leave everybody frustrated. So, yeah, we're very much, in some sense, learning the lessons of the failure of the good governance agenda to focus too much too soon on trappings of democracy like elections and not enough mechanics of democracy like deliberation and civil society spaces for decision making, and too much on the trappings of a capable bureaucracy like civil service laws and other things, and not enough on the mechanics of how things get done. We don't, like, we don't piss off people that often, like, directly, by, because after all, if we attack it, we're just going to attract a lot of antagonism, so we just are kind of working on a track of allowing it to happen and ignoring that. Does that make sense?
I think we should be clear that we want good governance, like, as a noun.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but there's a means to an end, right? And the standard means is what we're often, is what we're trying to be critical of. So, we mentioned this morning, but sort of one of those weird moments in one's professional life, when, like, as you may know, there's a group in Washington called Global Integrity, whose job it is, a self-appointed job, to scorecard the quality of anti-corruption laws around the world. Right? And Uganda happens to score 99 out of 100 for its anti-corruption law. You cannot buy a better, literally, cannot buy a better wordsmithed legal anti-corruption law than what Uganda has. Right? But as it happens, when Matt and I, all three of us, were invited down to a workshop in Uganda, that the screaming headline on the day we arrived was 200 million shilling program from DFID cancelled because of the corruption scheme. So if the good governance agenda is just like changing the form, changing what things look like, all this isomorphic stuff, then it becomes decoration, because we can proudly claim we've got the best anti-corruption law in the world. But if we can't do the work of an anti-corruption law to stop people using public money for private purposes, then clearly you haven't got good governance happening. And so treating or engaging with these kinds of problems in a very different way is what we're really on about. But recognizing that we're not offering a pill either. We're not sort of saying there's a simple way to do this. This is the equivalent degree of difficulty of learning a foreign language, speaking playing a new musical instrument. When Lant gave his original wider lecture here, he had the temerity to explain to people how to juggle. Right? Now, having explained to you all a juggle, he got a Finnish official in the front row, tossed him three balls, and said, "Now you juggle." Right? And of course, the balls kind of went everywhere. Right? Because it doesn't matter how many lectures you've heard on how to be a good juggler, until you've actually juggled, you don't know how to do this stuff. And part of what this, but the key part of what this agenda is really on, is putting people on this Hirschmanian long voyage of discovery to figure out how to juggle, to figure out how to learn how to do difficult things under pressure at scale for everyone. That's what the development vision should be here. And you can fake your way to that, or by short-term credibility, maybe with some hope that that will, you know, enable you to fake it till you make it, as some people say. But the underlying, whatever that is, has to be done as a way station, or a pretty deeply calculated wager that something's going to come out of that, that is actually good governance as a lived experience. And so often, as we well know, in too many places, that is not the experience. And even in rich countries, that can be for certain demographic groups, or for particular people in a certain parts of the income spectrum, their experience of this thing called good governance can be the exact opposite of that. And so a movie like I, Daniel Blake, and others that I think that are very powerful in showing just how awful systems can be for people, even in countries that invented this modern civil service, I think it's never over. It's never, you never reach done. This is a perpetual, even for governments that think they've got this figured out, it's perpetual work. You still have to keep learning how to be good at this, because the marvel of development is that we just can routinely do amazing things, like fly to this country from around the world and be perfectly sure that we'll arrive, that there is electricity in this room, that the air is clean, that the water we drink is safe. There's, none of us bats an eyelid over all that, but these amazing bureaucratic systems deliver all of that stuff because it's been practiced and routinized every single hour of every single day. And the development vision on a good day is about sort of moving somehow a little bit more in a direction like that. And we like to think that something like PDIA is a lesson from history, as it were, about how these functionalities are acquired, not by endless sermonizing, not by imposing one system on top of another, but by working with what you've got and working through locally legitimate change processes to build out this bigger apparatus of functionality. And that's just a long voyage of discovery. We should have known that for 50 years, but we just haven't. And we're crazy enough to try and sort of instantiate that principle into a more codified work program that hopefully will get some traction in a few places.
Other questions? Are we running over time? Or
we're having
how
too much
time?
Fun.
We don't want to keep people from their appointed tasks, but we don't want to leave people to leave with questions unanswered.
All right,
we take three questions and then we'll wrap up?
Hi, practitioner, so it all sounds great to me. I'm just interested to know some of the experiences that you've had here, like for instance with DFID or DFAT or whatever. You know, how do they actually take the first step to move away from, say, a log frame approach or a result framework approach? What
does that look like?
Physically, what happens? I haven't read the book yet. I just don't.
Oh, that's not it. Isn't it? No one was crazy enough to try this until we wrote the book. So
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Rachel.
Yeah. So this was great. I mean, as you know, I'm a big fan of your work, and it's nice to hear what you've been doing with it since, with this, especially in Michael's presentation. But I guess I'm struck in your presentations that you're really talking about very well-meaning actors. I mean, all of the actors in the seem to be very well-meaning and public-minded. But sometimes institutions don't function because some actors benefit from that dysfunction, right? They're dysfunctional because it's functional for certain actors to be dysfunctional. So I wonder how you deal with those actors in PDA.
Mm-hmm. Any last?
Cue that hand up. Yeah.
Just quickly building on a couple of the other questions, I think the problem-centered approach is very important, and just applying to the governance issue, is it not possible in your view to approach issues of governance or challenges of governance also from a problem-centered perspective and being problem-driven, and rather than coming up with ready-made solutions regarding civil service certifications? So just that was the question, and maybe also just building on what you mentioned, I'm also from the Finnish Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I want to ask about what is it that donors can do that's good, that can benefit this kind of approach? I see a lot of references to kind of this kind of innovation approaches, problem-driven solutions. What have donors done that have worked, and what have donors done that can make this more challenging also in your perception?
So, and maybe we'll do it sequentially. I mean, so I think one of the things that suffuses this whole approach is what we call a strategic incremental approach, which is, you know, which is be incremental in tactics with strategic in the vision. And one of the elements of that is don't attack the bad guys where they live first, right? What I think people look for too much is the Lee Kuan Yew, Paul Kagame experience, where a developmentalist leader pushes down with top-down pressure to create it. Whereas our experience is, even in like super hostile environments in which many bad actors control a lot of what happens, there are spaces to work productively, because there are issues and problems that the bad actors want solved, or at least won't block you from solving. So part of the techniques of the course are what we call AAA analysis. What do you have the authorization to do? What can you create a political space to work on? What do you have the ability to do? And what do you have the acceptance to do? And, you know, our approach is work on that. You know, and I think a lot of the political-driven approaches often start from an analysis of the politics that concludes everything's impossible because the world's full of bad people. Look, if we wait till the world's not full of bad people to make progress, we never make progress. And that's not, in fact, how the now developed countries came to have good governance. They didn't wait till there wasn't corruption, wait till there weren't warlords, wait till they... So I think this approach emphasizes that in nearly every circumstance, there's something you can work on that you don't have to... You know, if I were, like, defeating a powerful enemy, I don't attack him in his castle first. I, like, look, where are spots that I'm not going to get the maximum resistance so I can build my strength to be stronger the next battle we fight rather than, again, the head-on, top-down reform just is always, you know, nearly always going to fail. And so we're kind of, we end up being kind of anti too much political analysis. It's like, look for the concrete of what you can do rather than do, you know, a larger scale political and economic thing at the general level. So I think strategic incrementalism suffuses this. Now, what we fear is incrementalism, that we just work on the periphery and never attack the castle. We're building that way, but, you know, we're weak and they're strong, so we want to start that way. Just one question on the donor side. I think there's two things that the donors are doing and can do. One is, you know, allow problem definition stage to be long. You know, too many donor programs start from a problem and then only want to iterate on solutions to the problem that they, not the local, have defined. And so we find in experience, you know, the donors want the problem definition to be a two-day workshop, right? Whereas often the problem definition phase takes 6 months. You actually have to let it play out to learn what is it that you really have authorization to work on versus what will the local authorities give you rhetorical, yes, 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 we're very concerned about what you say you want to spend money on because we want you to spend money here, but don't really have a deep commitment to the being problem-driven around it. So I think first thing is you just have to allow for a longer problem definition phase in your project in some way that gets, and again, that's often difficult given the finite mechanisms. The second is, I think, you know, Michael was talking about kind of the intermediary steps. And the difficulty is that all Western agencies are and have to be fine-grained, legalistic, barbarian bureaucracies. You know, DFID can't say to the British government, we're working in places that don't, like, really operate with the rule of law, so we're really not going to operate with the rule of law. It's like, no, not going to happen. So the key question is, how do you connect, like, a super powerful source of electricity to wires that can't carry very much current? And the answer is, you need resistors, right? Every electronic device has little things in them called resistors. And what they do is they step down the power between what comes in and what the thing needs. So if I were, as I design a project, I always design a buffer organization. So in some sense, the donor disperses to a local organization on a series of terms and conditions of what the local donor organization kind of at a high formal level is going to do, and then allow that organization to interface directly with the mechanism, which provides you two things. One, it provides you a way to disperse money to the country and then let the disbursement profile of the money into the country be responsive to the speed with which things happen, rather than what happened. And I worked for a donor agency for many enjoyable years. The enjoyable years weren't the total of the years I worked there, but and the problem with donor funds is you get under disbursement pressure, and then you're pushing the PDIA process to accelerate so that you can get the money dispersed. Whereas if you have a buffer organization, you can get the money dispersed without, again, putting too much current through the system and blowing all the circuits. And then second, you can also buffer yourself again, you know, think of you're coming out of this, you know, super high voltage bureaucratic system that you work for in Finland that has to operate, of course, like the rest of the Finnish government, which is at very high, precise procurement levels. And you've got to work in villages in Nigeria. You've got to put buffers in between you and them so that the deliberative long-term processes can happen, facilitated by the buffer organizations. Everybody understand what I mean? So, you know, one of our heroes, Scott Guggenheim, designed a community development project in Indonesia, and one of the geniuses of that project was it was going to build little bridges, and I mean bridges. Indonesia was full of places where you kind of just needed a 10-meter bridge to connect parts of the village, or you needed, you know, small-scale infrastructure. And in order to do that, they set up a fund where the bank dispersed into the fund in huge units, hundreds of millions of dollars. But then the village didn't have to comply with World Bank procurement. They had to comply with the procurement standards of the fund, which could be locally adapted to be super simple, one-page, you know, necessary accounting. So anyway, think in terms of how do I buffer between the environment I live in Finland and the environment I need to work in. And I think a lot of program design doesn't build enough buffers in, and it pressures you on time and it pressures you on process in ways that are incompatible with being adequately flexible. So that's kind of a pragmatic thing.
Yeah, mine would be equivalently pragmatic in the sense that I think another one of your aphorisms is we can't want it more than they do. So much as we might be super concerned about this, if you just, there are some people or organizations that you just really, really kind of can't do business with, and that's okay. I mean, that's just the nature of this. But that said, I got early on in this process, 4 or 5 years ago, I got an email from a group doing police reform in Afghanistan, right? I thought, man, I can't think of a tougher country and a tougher sector. If these guys can somehow make PDIA work, everyone else is on easy street. Like, you know, don't regale me with your tough story. Like, if I, and so this the organization, that this consulting company that was asked to do this, the only country that we could all get to, that where all the different stakeholders could get to easily, it turned out to be India. So they flew me and 15 other people to Delhi for a 3-day workshop on all this sort of stuff, and it was a version of, you know, just so emotionally intense working with people. Like, doing this kind of work means I risk getting my kids kidnapped on the way to school. Right? That's what people are saying when they're talking about what's the problem. Right? That's the level of what they're dealing with. Right? So, and I get super emotional talking with people like that. I'm like, no one's trying to kidnap my kids on the way to school. Like, the fact that people are signing up, taking us so seriously that they actually think that this is a credible strategy for doing the most difficult work of reform in one of the most difficult countries in the whole world. So how did that happen? I think, like, can I sort of just tentatively all the different questions that you just pulled of you apart. It was a different funding, right? So I don't know the granular details of which particular part of the governance group in DFID decided this was something that they wanted to spend 4 years of work on. It wasn't just a cute little thing. They were committed to doing, to building out an authorizing environment for 4 years to do this work. If I had a company that was willing to put staff into a country for pretty high expense for 4 years to do this, and I hired people who spoke Pashtun, who'd learned the local languages and could communicate very directly to people doing this kind of work. And they just sent us last week their first blog post at the culmination of this project about how they took at least, not necessarily the full package of PDIA, but pretty what they were assigned, or what they signed up to do when they agreed to do this particular work. And you know, no one's going to claim that, oh, now they've got the, you know, fantastic police force and this is fantastic. We've got a rigorous evaluation strategy with sort of, we've got treatments and controls. And it just feels facile to talk that way to people who risk what they do to do this kind of work. And so they've got a good narrative, they've got a good account that's for the moment pretty plausible for how they've been able to build out the functionalities of the police force. And if that needle went from there to there, that's amazing. The counterfactual world was probably likely that it would have gone even worse than it was before. So a lot of the work that's being done in Papua New Guinea by the Australian government, that's $200 million worth of work that's being done in an anthropological country that doesn't even have a really coherent sense of being a nation state, and yet they're still trying to figure out how to make the beginnings of the national identity and national government function in a country like that, and they're choosing PDIA as their modality for doing that kind of work. And Papua New Guinea is an amazing, amazing country for sociologists in particular, maybe, but for anyone sort of trying to see how crucial it is to build national narratives. And Lant mentioned Scott Guggenheim after his work in Indonesia. He's just finished a 7-year stint trying to do versions of what he'd done in Indonesia in Afghanistan. And that's one of his big takeaways, was just the existential challenge is how you build out this bigger national narrative about people being part of something bigger than just their own particular identity group. And there's been certain ways in which the approach that they took in Indonesia has been able to get some traction in Afghanistan in a different kind of way. But there's also an array of different countries that are now trying to do this kind of thing. And part of our task is to document that, be as indifference from an ideological point of view as we should be, and treat and learn from this. Although I've just done a huge big paper on this, on the Nigeria work, which was really sort of a good, bad, and the ugly story about what happens when a big government tries to do a huge big healthcare reform exercise and tries to take a slice of that and do it by PDIA. I can't stand before you with a straight face and say this was the best thing that they've ever tried. It was just really hard. And it was super difficult. But there are these amazing, unexpected things that happened as well in a very positive way. And so if you only have a particular research methodology set up to assess very clearly what was supposed to be done, then you miss all these other unobservable things statistically that were going on. So we can tell some really interesting stories about how all this work is playing out. But it really is this, the authorizing environment, whether you're dealing with authoritarian, democratic, whether you're dealing with donors or with multilaterals or with doing domestic governments, so that authorizing environment is so central to protecting and sustaining this whole enterprise. And part of the reason we want the PD part to go on so long is because it really does give you a sense, not just of the specifics of the problems you're dealing with, but how robust actually is your authorizing environment. Mm. How will it tolerate that kind of time and not just be tapping fingers on the desk waiting for the answers to magically appear? And so the stuff that Matt Andrews, our colleague on this, has done in Sri Lanka, they took 6 or 7 months to figure out how to get to a point where they could now start to enhance direct foreign investment, which you would think would be a nice technical exercise. Guys offering incentives of one kind or another to get people to show up and invest in new factories or whatever. And they just, what was the problem was had very little to do with the regulatory environment. All these are the nice sort of indicators that we might otherwise try and scrub up and aggregate and league table around the world. All the rest of it, just, it had much more to do with building the capability of people to do the actual work of courting foreign investors. And that just, and what their problems of actual or potential or previous investors had encountered when they tried to do this. And they had no data or no evidence or any institutional memory for how all of that had played out. So helping that team to acquire that level of granular functionality was the task that they undertook there. But I think these DDD gatherings are places where we want donors to be there, as they were very strongly at the Berlin meeting, where they're sharing with each other and with us about how their own organizations are lining up around all of this. And I think it's still, we want this to be an open question. We don't ever want to be claiming we've cracked a code here. We think we're just being consistent historically with how organizations work. We take the history of this stuff seriously. When a place like Chicago was the equivalent of the badlands of many countries in the world back in the 1890s, and functionality came out of that somehow. And it wasn't because people just waited around, because they built it. They figured out how to constrain authority or constrain rogue authority and bring it under this canopy called the rule of law. So all of those rich historical experiences, I think, can be a reservoir of insight and inspiration, if nothing else, for how one functions and does tough work in tough places. But if what we're doing can sort of make that a little bit more legible, a little bit more actionable, a little more credible and legitimate, then so much the better. But ultimately, this is about building out the orchestra, building out the, getting other people to be able to do this stuff, not about us. But anyway, thanks very much.
But, by the way, one last thing is that we invent, speaking of donors, we spent a long time and invented an acronym in PDAA because we knew that the only way we would get donors to adopt it is if it had a four-letter acronym so that individual staff could say, when your boss said, what the hell is this? You say, oh, I'm doing PDAA. It's the latest thing. And then they're like, well, it has an acronym. It must be a thing. So we were already thinking about how we could create an authorizing environment for people to do it by saying, well, some guy from Harvard say this four-letter acronym PDAA is the greatest thing. That's what I'm doing right now. And then they'll go, okay, yeah, I don't want to know any more than that. Anyway, sorry.
That's excellent. That's excellent. Wow, this was so inspiring. Thank you ever so much. And I think we could have gone on for hours on this. I sort of sense that everyone in the room recognizes what you're talking about, what the problem is. I came to think of an example from when I was working with our country program in Tanzania. And we were indeed decorating the anti-corruption work brilliantly as a donor group. And there was this brilliant brochure that had been produced with our money on ghost workers. It had categories of different kinds of ghost workers. There was the sleeping ghost, and there was the dead ghost, and there were drawings of all the different kinds, like, wow, you know, this is probably making a big impact on governance in this country and anti-corruption work. Anyway, so exactly, we know what you're talking about. And I think what really is the most inspiring part of your work is that going from that critique and understanding of what the problems are to actually trying to find ways of correcting it. I really like your strategic incrementalism. And I'm also thinking of work that we're trying to do within our own organizations where the same kind of approaches sometimes apply. And there are people who work in my department, so that's probably exactly what they're doing. And yeah, there are sometimes four-letter acronyms that I've never heard of that they claim they're doing work on. So and maybe we'll have to change your title, Good Enough Governance Advisor, from now on.
That's very good.
Good enough.
Pretty okay governance. Anyway, thank you ever so much. And then another thing that I thought about listening to you is that we often think about the Finnish development story. You know, we've been an independent state for 101 years. When we became independent, we were a fragile, conflict-affected state. We went straight into a civil war. We were poor and, you know, not that well organized. And I think, you know, if it were somebody in, let's say, London or Berlin looking at that Finland over there, would not have thought that, oh, this is a future leader in all kinds of international, what are they called, comparisons.
Education.
But they would have said, oh, God, you know, those, you know, they'll never make it. And look at us now. So, but the problem is that we find as difficult is to, first of all, I mean, yes, we know the different kinds of things that led us here. It's not very easy to disentangle it, but still we know certain elements that brought us here. But then how do you share that story? How do you share it in a way that doesn't sound like, oh, we know the solutions, you know, just do like we did and, you know, you'll be fine. But I think that this kind of, you know, sharing thinking of the incremental steps and the spaces where people can actually make change is really a good way forward. So anyway, this afternoon and your work is yet again a great example of why Finland is a very proud partner of WIDER, and very happy to continue to support your work and collaborate with you. Very proud of this work, and thank you very much for this afternoon.